We have some time for questions from the audience, and while the ushers collect them, let me begin by asking this question. Dr. C, in addition to actions at the federal level, what are some things that states and localities can do or can be doing to improve their local industrial commons for manufacturing today?
Well, I think that is an area where I'm seeing a lot of positive action. I think the key things that localities can do is work with industries in their region on particularly the human capital needs. If you ask any manufacturer, and I've visited a lot of factories, if you ask any of them, the number one thing they'll say is, I need motivated workers with a good work ethic, okay? And I think by working with the educational systems, be they high schools or community colleges, to give potential workers kind of a flavor of what I can expect in manufacturing, and that it's a good career path, I think there's a great opportunity. But it really takes a dialogue of local government and firms and supporting institutions. We're seeing that in a lot of areas. I would point to the Carolinas, where they've done this very consistently for a number of years, and they're seeing very good benefits there.
Thank you. And one of the questions from the audience is examples of processes that would benefit from reshoring.
Processes that would benefit from reshoring. Well, I think if you look at any type of consumer goods which are relatively have a low value density. So, for example, you see this in appliances right now. GE and Appliance Park has brought a lot of their manufacturing back to Kentucky. And they said, in this era where fast product cycles are important and having engineering and product development close to manufacturing can benefit my competitiveness of the product in the marketplace, that's an example of a place that can benefit. So I think things that have a relatively low value density will be the obvious ones. Value density is really how much does it weigh, okay, or how big is it? Right, I would never air freight a refrigerator, for example. But things that have a relatively low value density, but good, reasonable value, and where there's a lot of technological change in the product, those are great opportunities right now.
And as kind of a follow-up to that, another question from the audience is: manufacturing companies are saying they can't find people with appropriate skills. How can K through 12 public education provide support to the manufacturing industry here locally?
Well, I think it's a job and an opportunity both for the school systems as well as the firms. Okay, and a lot of that is about setting an understanding of what a manufacturing job is today. A lot of people have grown up these days, young people, thinking manufacturing jobs are dirty work. Actually, if you go inside a lot of factories today, they're very high tech. There's a high degree of automation. There's a lot of information technology. There's sophisticated tools that are employed. So I think the education system can help set the expectation that this is actually a good career path. I think for a long time, for a number of years now, we've set the expectation that everybody needs to go to college, okay? I'm not convinced that that's right for everybody, all right? But what the education system can do is really highlight the career opportunities, and I say career, that manufacturing offers, and it offers good jobs.
Another question from the audience is, given your focus on the necessity of an industrial commons for long-term manufacturability, what things do you see that we could be doing in the state of New Hampshire?
Well, I think the important thing is to focus on areas that we have strength, where there's where it's kind of a cross-industry complementary asset that multiple industries would use. Okay, so things like, there are a lot of firms in New Hampshire that rely on machining, okay, precision machining, okay. What can the state do to make this a favorable environment for other firms to maintain their investment or increase their investment in local manufacturer that can, that keeps those suppliers in business? I think you really have to think about the supplier network, the educational infrastructure, all these pieces that support those firms. So I think it starts with really mapping out what are the sectors where we're strong, and then saying what are the ones that are at risk.
Well, this is really good news. I think we have a yellow card from everyone that's here. So this is great for manufacturing in the Monadnock region. Many people suggest that government intervention is the answer to our manufacturing needs for more onshoring. Is this really true?
Well, I think the problem with government intervention, and this this goes to the classic question of, you know, what role should the government play? And where should the government invest, and where should one leave it to the market? Okay, the problem with the government trying to do too much, and oftentimes we hear people talking about picking winners and losers, is it's impossible for relatively small teams in a government agency to have as much information or as much wisdom as all the players in the marketplace. All right, so the way I think of it is the government can invest early on in things like basic science, basic research, which many people would classify as a public good, right? Because they're outside of the horizon that a private firm can hope to earn a return on. Right, so a lot of people would say basic science, basic research, that's the province for the government. Invest into that as a public good. Okay, when you get down to the marketplace, let the marketplace decide, let firms decide. What the government's role there needs to be is make the country an attractive place to invest. Okay. Simplify regulation, right? Fix the tax code. Right? I can't tell you how many firms that I hear about who are thinking about, I'm going to relocate operations because if I move my shipping point to Ireland or Macau or somewhere like that, how many cents per share am I going to see on my earnings statement? And it's fairly substantial. All right, so we have a complex tax code with lots of preferences, and I think we inadvertently chase a lot of firms offshore in the process.
Thank you. Another question from the audience is, and this one's a little different, could you please discuss the cost and availability of raw materials as they impact manufacturing and their location?
Yes, okay, so that's actually a key factor. So one of the things that is helping the U.S. right now is this fracking boom. Okay, so natural gas in the U.S. Costs one-third to one-quarter as much as it does in Germany. And natural gas is the feedstock for a lot of basic chemicals like ethylene, you know, polyethylene, polycarbonate, things like that, plastics. Okay, so having relatively low costs really favors any industry that's going to use petrochemicals right now. There's a really interesting example of this If you look at General Electric, GE, they used to have a plastics operation, and back in the early 2000s, they sold it to a company called SABIC, Saudi Arabia Basic Industries Company. And at the time, it seemed like a good idea because they said, you know, we don't have access to feedstocks at competitive costs. The Saudis have all this oil and gas. It makes sense for them to buy SABIC, otherwise we're not going to be competitive. You know where SABIC's newest manufacturing location is? Houston, Texas. Okay, so but that kind of highlights, so you need to look at your input costs, and when one region has a favorable input cost, I mean labor is an input cost, and when China has an advantage, in those areas where I have inexpensive labor, it favors my moving manufacturing there. So I think it's actually a very important area.
Thank you. Here in northern New England, there is much interest in business models that are locally owned, environmentally sensitive, and sustainable. Can you please comment on future opportunities for these businesses in the future of global economy?
Well, so I think the locally owned thing is really interesting, right? Because if we come back to the trade, how tradable is it, right? Do you care if the your order at the McDonald's was outsourced to a call center, right? No, I don't. That made it tradable, right? You know, when you say locally owned and sustainable is part of that, right? What you're really saying is I'm going to give the consumer perceived or actual value if that good is not as tradable, right? If it's produced within a local region. So, I mean, I think that helps, right? It helps.
And here's a question that's close to my heart. Will grassroots efforts such as makerspaces have an impact on the economics of impact on either the economics or technology of large-scale manufacturing?
Well, I think the potentially the best impact of the whole makerspace movement is getting young people interested in making products again. Okay. I think that is potentially the best long-term benefit, but it's also impacting a lot of companies' thinking in terms of rapid product innovation, right? So I think the combination of those two things actually bode very well. Actually, if you look at when I speak abroad, right, everybody is very concerned that the U.S. might actually get its act together on this reshoring thing, and what are we going to do about it? And makerspaces is one of the things they talk about a lot.
Compare how Germany's manufacturing in the 90s and the 2000s, and compare those to U.S. manufacturing today.
Japanese manufacturing?
German. Sorry.
You know, Germany is really interesting. If you look at German manufacturing, there's a big chunk which is the auto industry. And if you look at the big automakers, which is BMW Group, the Daimler Group, and Volkswagen, they have managed to capture a lot of the luxury car segment. The more interesting part about German manufacturing is what is known as this Mittelstand, which are the smaller, medium-sized firms who tend to be global champions in very narrow niche products. I was just in Germany 3 weeks ago, and we were driving by one town where the world leader in tire chains is. Okay, and then there's another part of southern Germany where if you want a machine that makes, compresses the drugs for a pharmaceutical tablet, they all come from there, okay? And so it's actually more than Germany, but Germany and Switzerland and also northern Italy, right? If you buy a carbonated beverage, a Coca-Cola bottle, right? It was invariably filled on a machine that was made in northern Italy or Switzerland, okay? But so what you have is you have a lot of these small to medium-sized companies that have invested and continue to invest in very narrow areas and are global leaders. And one of the reasons Germany has done well is because they provide the tools for emerging economies, for the U.S., for everybody that are the means of production. Interestingly, a lot of these firms are family-owned or foundation-controlled, so they're able to take kind of a long-horizon view on things.
And this would be the last question for today, is how do people who historically have spent years in high-paying routine assembly jobs compare with foreign labor in today's economy?
Well, one thing that I have observed in foreign labor, especially when you go to emerging market factories, and I've been through a lot of factories, probably over 1,000. One of the things that you see is, and by the way, I've also been in some factories in the U.S. that are really good. And I think the things that characterize those are a workforce that has a lot of intrinsic motivation, okay, and is hungry, and a firm that is also striving to do better and is hungry. Some of the best manufacturing operations I've seen in the world are in the U.S., okay, but you know, there are a lot of things that you can do in China that we can't do in the U.S. anymore because of the structure of their labor market, right? If you want to produce 5 million iPhones to ship on the first weekend of product launch, you'd never be able to do that in the U.S. Okay, so there are a lot of differences, but it's not that we don't have strength in this country. It's just I think we're only beginning to identify the importance of preserving that. The lesson that we learned in the late 80s as well.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Xi, for being with us today. I'd also like to thank the audience for some outstanding questions. This is the Monadnock Summer Lyceum, hosted by the Unitarian Universalist Church in Peterborough, New Hampshire, and broadcast on New Hampshire Public Radio. You've been listening to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum on New Hampshire Public Radio. The Monadnock Summer Lyceum presents weekly series of lectures held at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Peterborough, New Hampshire. For more information about the Lyceum, you can visit our website at www.monadnocklyceum.org. The program next Sunday will feature Dr. Gail Dines speaking about growing up in a porn culture. Now please join us in the parish hall for more time with our presenter, and for some refreshments, which have been most generously provided by the Greater Peterborough Chamber of Commerce. I'd also like to take this opportunity to thank Sidney Wilson Smith, who kindly provided us with the beautiful flowers here today. If you asked a question that was not answered during the program, please feel free to ask it during the reception. We'd like to hear from you about your experiences today, and we encourage you to fill out the blue card found in your pews. We hope you will give us feedback on today's program and join our mailing list as well. You can either mail a blue card to us or drop the blue card in the bowls alone or with your contributions to the sustainability of the Monadnock Summer Lyceum. Thank you all very much for coming today and making possible this lively dialogue.